Well, it's baseball season, and in baseball season, as the playoffs are going on, it's a time for reflection, and I tend to look back and try to think of what we could salvage out of this year. Neither of our teams, the Giants and the A's, are in the playoffs, and so all we have to do is remember the good times, the memories that we have. And one of the things that I've been grateful for is I've looked at the A's story. I see one of my all-time favorite pitchers is Barry Zito. Barry Zito is one of the guys that I've been tracking. He's a left-handed pitcher who started with the A's on the other side of the bay in Oakland. And as he started, one of the things that he was known for was a wicked curveball. A curveball. Now, if you're not a baseball fan, let me just kind of, you know, there's a pitcher, there's a hitter, and there's different kinds of pitches you can throw. And the ones that get you to the major leagues are your fastball. You gotta have a fastball. It's a pretty kind of straight pitch, but it's really fast. The thing that got Barry to the major leagues was his curveball. A curveball is something that you hold a certain way and you snap your wrist and the action on the ball makes it go this high so the batter thinks it's coming up at his eyes, but then at the last minute it just sinks downward right into the catcher's mitt. And oftentimes when you see a hitter looking at a good curveball, it looks like this. He's up here and then he's about to swing, but he realizes, oh no, it's not a fastball. It's going so slow. And his knees buckle. He's frozen. He can't move. That's a good curveball. That's what we got to see with Barry Zito all the time. When his curveball was working, there were hitters that looked just completely silly, just paralyzed, couldn't move. Because they couldn't see the ball, they couldn't time the ball, and that's a good curveball. I say that because that's life oftentimes will present us with curveballs. Life gives us curves all the time. And curveballs come from all different directions. They can come from the world around us. You can go to the doctor and the doctor can tell you terminal cancer. That's a curve. You can go to work and all of a sudden your employer comes up to you, your supervisor, and says, we got to lay you off. That's a curve. Sometimes they come from the people around you, people who you know well. A curveball can come in the form of a friend who you've just trusted and known for a long time, and all of a sudden, unexpectedly, they betray you. A friend betraying you. That's a curveball. Sometimes those curveballs come from within us. It's the actions that we do, our responses to situations where we realize, boy, you know, I'm angry and I said something I shouldn't have said and I hurt somebody. I didn't see that coming. Or it's a choice that we make for entertaining ourselves or to go and try some drugs or try gambling or try pornography or try doing something. We're surprised by it, and curves like that come from within. I didn't realize that I would do that. But what happens oftentimes when we get a curveball, whether it's from life or from people around us or even from within us, what happens? How's our reactions to those kinds of things? It can be a lot like that hitter who just sees that unexpected pitch and just can't move. They get buckled under. They can't just be free to swing. They're paralyzed, can't move throughout life. I wonder what's thrown you a curve. What's thrown you a curve in your life where you just got blindsided, the rug got pulled out from under you, something happened to you that just shouldn't have happened, you just didn't see it coming, and all of a sudden you're just trying to make sense of everything and you can't move. You can't move. Those curves can be crippling to us. When we start making choices to do things that are addictive, then all of a sudden we're in an addiction to porn, we're in an addiction to gambling, and we're in addiction to drugs or addicted to food. There's all kinds of things that if we give ourselves over to it, we can get controlled and crippled by the thing we give ourselves to. So curveballs can then end up crippling us. Curves from within cripple us in so many different ways. Well, this is the story of Mephibosheth. You have to say his name about 10 times just so it rolls off your tongue. But like Ruth, if you just stumble over it, you go, is that really a name? That's a name, Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth has the story of getting a curveball at his life that he never would have seen happening. Just imagine this for a minute. His story actually begins in chapter 4, and I'll just give it to you, where we find out how this curve hit him. Imagine for yourself that you are 5 years old playing on the palace grounds in Israel, out there with your nanny and just having a great time in the royal palace there in Jerusalem. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere comes this pandemonium. People coming in and out of the palace. They're scared. They're shrieking. They're screaming. Some are crying. Everybody's running. Everyone's packing. Everyone's getting everything out, loading up and leaving the palace, getting out of the palace. You're 5 years old. You don't know what's going on. But the next thing you see is your nanny coming towards you, ready to scoop you up, pick you up. And there you go, 5 years old, in the arms of this nanny. And as she's running, which seems for her life, you don't know why, but you're running. She's running with you. Then she loses grip on you and tosses you hard on the ground. And it's hard in a way that does damage to you. It hurts you. You land so awkwardly and you realize that you can't move your legs. You can't move your feet. You're crippled. Maybe it was a spinal injury, something that happened that you cannot use your feet. You're 5 years old and you can't use your feet. Well, the nanny doesn't have any time to tend to your wound, doesn't have any time to get anything to help you. All she wants to do is get you out because there's something going on that is causing her to say, we got to get out of here. So she takes your crippled self, picks you up, and runs and runs and runs. And as you're going a long journey. You're getting down to this area that's southeast of the Jordan or the Galilee. And there you get into this town called Lo Debar. You've never been there. It's Lo Debar actually means no thing, nothing. Lo Debar, it's the place of nothing. You don't know what this place is, and yet you're here. There's some familiar faces. Part of the Saul's family is here, and all the while you're wondering, where's my daddy? Where's my daddy? And you're calling out because you're in pain. You don't know where you are. Well, you start to understand after some time that your daddy died. Your daddy is dead. He was killed in a battle. And not only your dad died, but your grandfather, Saul, died as well. His daddy was Jonathan. Jonathan's daddy was Saul. The king of Israel and his son died in battle. That's why they had to leave the palace. Because once they died, then David's forces were now going to come into Jerusalem, take over the throne, take over the palace. And customarily what would happen in that culture is if you were going to take over, one family was going to replace another family. That family coming in was going to wipe out the other family. That was just how it was done in that day. And there were little stories of that happening where slowly Saul's clan started getting picked off, people dying. This wasn't David's intention, though. There were people working for him, people who thought this would be a good way to get on David's side, who actually worked for Jonathan's family and started killing off Saul's family. And David said, no, 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 don't do that. There was one son left of Saul's. And it was the servant of this one son who ended up killing this son, thinking that David would like that. David didn't like that and had them killed, actually. But there's Mephibosheth. His father died. His grandfather died. His 2 feet are crippled. He's in this whole new environment. And he grows up like this over some years, growing up until probably about 20 years old. And the next thing that you know is you get a knock on the door there in Lo Debar, in the middle of nowhere, crippled, still crippled. You're not better. There aren't services for disabilities, right? They don't have those then. We have all that here. They didn't have surgical repair. If you needed a new foot or something like that, you didn't have any of that. If you were crippled, you're crippled. And in that society, when you're crippled, you're marginalized. You're put off to the side. You're useless. There's nothing that you have to offer. So you're over here, Mephibosheth. Out of sight, hidden. So there he is, traumatized, crippled, and hidden away until he gets a knock on the door. And there is the very people that work for King David at the door. And they're saying, by the king's command, you're to come with us back to Jerusalem into the palace to see King David. Now, if you're Mephibosheth, is that good news or bad news? Yeah, you're not thinking, oh, great, a trip to Jerusalem. Haven't been back to Jerusalem in a long time. It'll be good to be back. You're not thinking that. You're thinking, I know what happened to the rest of my family. And now it's my turn. That's probably what he's thinking. It was a long ride back to Jerusalem, probably. As he comes back into the palace, that's where we pick it up here. If you look back in chapter 9, in verse 6, when Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, again, came to David. Again, he's reciting who this Mephibosheth is. He's the son of the enemy. The son of the enemy is now in the palace of King David. Who's in charge? Who's not in charge? Who is powerful? Who is powerless? And in that moment, he bowed down to pay him honor. And in the Hebrew itself, what it truly extends here is there's this picture of Mephibosheth coming down, fleeing himself on his face, down on the ground, prostrating himself before David, probably in terror. Okay, that's the picture that we have. He's face planted before David. Okay, and with that, David says, Mephibosheth. He says his name. And what's the significance of saying his name? Part of it is the meaning of his name. Mephibosheth, the name Mephibosheth means destruction of shame. The destruction of shame. And so there is Mephibosheth with his crippled feet down to the ground. And you don't know how he got down to the ground, probably awkwardly with his crippled feet, but there he is, down on the ground, prostrate, in terror, just fearing for his life, and David says his name, Mephibosheth, destruction of shame. No shame, Mephibosheth, no shame. He addresses him by telling him he does not need to be ashamed of who he is. For all those years, he had lived in hiding, lived as an outcast, internalized all that, and just had a sense that he is a shameful person. And David is calling him out and saying, no shame. No shame in the presence of the king. No shame. And he says, at your service, he replied. And then David's second word is another word of grace. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. He said to him, for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father, Jonathan. Now, it's important that we know the history here. In the history of David and Jonathan, back in 1 Samuel 20, Jonathan and David formed a very strong friendship. They were brother to brother. They were friends. And when I mean friends, I don't mean the kind of friends we have on Facebook. Okay? I mean friends. I mean, the friendships that we have nowadays are just not, I cannot even give you a picture of what this is. It is a tenderness, an affection, a loyalty where one would die for the other. That's the kind of friendship that's happening between David and Jonathan. So way back, when King Saul was still the king, David was still running around. Jonathan knew that David was eventually going to be the king. He was anointed to be the king. And so they formed a covenant with one another. And in 1 Samuel 20, Jonathan says, I promise that I will treat you and your family well. And he made David make the same promise back to them, back to him. David promised, I will always treat you and your family for generations well. That was a covenant that they had together. Now David, King Saul is dead. Jonathan is dead. The commander of their army is dead. There's no one who is a threat to David except this Mephibosheth, who's part of the king's line. But he's no threat, really. But he wants to make sure that he's good on his promise to his father, Jonathan. I've got to be good on this covenant that I made. And I'm going to show kindness. And when we look upwards, we can see in verse 3, as David is trying to find out, is there no one still alive from the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness? I want you to see David's intent here. What does David really want to do? He doesn't want to just be nice. It's not like those commercials you see on TV on human kindness. Those are nice and those are sentimental. But he wants to show God's kindness. What is God's kindness? God's kindness is a kindness that extends mercy to those who don't deserve it. It's a kindness that covers over a multitude of sins. In Romans chapter 2, it says that God's kindness is a kindness that is always giving and giving that leads us to repentance, to turn ourselves around when we're so overwhelmed by his kindness that we would turn back to this great God who would be so kind to us. That's the kind of kindness that David wants to show the family of his enemy. Do you see the picture of grace yet? The truth of the matter is, all of us, you and me, we are all Mephibosheth. You are Mephibosheth. I am Mephibosheth. We are crippled by the curves of this life. We are crippled by the curves of our own sin. And by that, that leaves us in a place of shame. It leaves us realizing that we're not living the lives that God intended for us to live. We're not the people that we were meant to be. Either from the outside or from the inside, we're not the people we're intended to be. And there's this nagging sense of shame that we live with. And we can try to compensate for it. We can try to get a great job and make a lot of money, and or we can try to be funny so that people can just think we're funny and don't deal with the hidden shame that we feel. We can find all kinds of ways to compensate for that, but everybody's walking around with it. Everybody. We're all Mephibosheth. And God comes to us and says, no shame. In my presence, no shame. Romans 8, there's no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. No shame. Don't be afraid, God says to us. Don't be afraid. Yeah, it is a holy terror to be in my presence, and the presence of a holy God is a holy thing, and that should be terrifying. But let me tell you, there is grace that I've given to you through my Son, Jesus Christ. The covenant that David had with Jonathan is like the covenant that God the Father has with the Son, where anyone who would come into the Son would be able to experience the grace that is there in Jesus Christ, because Jesus died on the cross for our shame. Jesus bore our guilt on the cross. Jesus took all of our unrighteousness on himself, so that as Jesus is as sitting at the table and the last day before he died, he says to his disciples, drink the cup. This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Drink all of it. That means there's a covenant here that you can know no shame, no fear because of this covenant. It's a covenant in my blood for you. That's why we can be in the presence of God with no shame. That's why we can be in the presence of God with no fear. Why? Because there's a covenant. It's a covenant between the Father and us through the Son, Jesus, the blood of Jesus that allows us to come and say, God is going to show us nothing but kindness. Nothing but kindness. That's all that God has for you. No condemnation. No fear, just kindness. We are all Mephibosheth, all of us. What is your response to this? What is your response? When you think about this, here is David, and he's saying, don't be afraid. And he specifically goes on in verse 7 and says, I will show you kindness for the sake of your father, Jonathan. And he says, I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather. That's one. All the land that was taken away, I'm going to bring it back. It's going to be yours. And there was a lot of land. And the second thing is, you will always eat at my table. You will always eat at my table. It's a picture of grace. How is Mephibosheth going to react? What's his reaction? Maybe it's your reaction too. Mephibosheth, in verse 8, bowed down and said, what is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me? You see, Mephibosheth had internalized all those years of being crippled, of being shamed, of being hidden away from society. And he internalized all of that and saying, I'm worthless. I'm not worth anything to anybody. I'm a dead dog. I'm crippled by life. Useless to nobody. Useful to nobody. Who am I? Why? Why would you consider me? Have you ever asked that to God? God, of all the people in the world, of all the billions of people in the world that you could extend grace and kindness to, why me? Why me? Of all the people that you could show your love to and you choose to, none of us deserve it, but why me? Why me? But David is absolutely serious in his intention. He doesn't just say words. The next thing he does, verse 9, the king summoned Ziba. Ziba was the servant of Saul. If you're like a Downton Abbey fan, he's the Carson, right? He's the Carson to the whole Abbey. He's the one who is loyal to the family. He brings Carson back in because he's loyal. Because he's loyal. And he says to him, and he says, I've given your master's grandson, Mephibosheth, everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons, all your servants, farm the land for him. Now it says how many servants there are at the end of 10. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. And so David is saying, I want you to get your 15 sons and 20 servants, and you are now all going to work for Mephibosheth. You're going to farm that land. So that tells you how big that piece of land was. It takes all those people to farm that land. That was a big amount of property. And so that's the new assignment for Ziba. You're to feed Mephibosheth, but it's not really Mephibosheth. It's his family, because David adds this one more thing. In verse 11, here Ziba said to the king, your servant will do whatever my lord the king commands his servant to do. So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. So all this land is being farmed out, crops are being produced, but it's really just to make sure that Mephibosheth and his family are taken care of. But Mephibosheth, every day, is going to sit at the king's table. Every day, he's going to sit at the king's table. And that's what he did. Verse 13, Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table. Again, he always ate at the king's table. I want you to imagine being at the royal dining hall of David. And you've got King David. And you've got his wife. You've got the family, the royal family there, right? Sometimes we think of the royal family in England and we think, oh, they're so pristine and civilized and sophisticated and regal in all of their way. You know, just imagine that table. There's King David and his family. They're all at their places waiting for the meal to come. But there's one more place there. And before the meal comes, you hear this. It's Mephibosheth walking in on his crippled feet. And everyone looks around and sees Mephibosheth. And hears David say, come on, Mephibosheth. We're waiting for you. There's a place at our table. All of us are Mephibosheth. When God extends grace to us, he does it because of a covenant that he has for us that is made available through his Son, who he sent into the world to die in our place, the perfect human being who took on all of our sins and shame and died on the cross so that all who would receive him would be washed clean, made children of the Most High God. You are now, because of Jesus and your faith in Jesus, you have a seat at the table of the King of the universe. Every day invites you to come and sit here and says, you belong. But it's interesting how the writer here ends this section. He says, he always ate at the king's table. He was lame in both feet. He ends with that. Just to remind us, it's not because of how great a person Mephibosheth was. It's not because he was a great, strong individual. It wasn't because he had all of his faculties or he was from the right family. In fact, it was despite all of those things. Despite all of those things, he always had a place at the king's table. Friend, do you know this grace? Part of the reason that we don't experience this grace is that we still think we're not able to really reveal that we're crippled. Can't afford to do that. That'd be too risky. Now, if I tell people that I've got issues, if I tell people of what happened to me, if I tell people this is my addiction, if I tell people that I've done some really bad things in my past, I would be outcast like Mephibosheth. I wouldn't want, no. What you're doing is you're denying yourself of the grace of God. You're denying yourself a seat at the table of the King. Why would you settle on living in hiding when you could settle on sitting at the table of the King every day of your life? Where you could wake up this morning and the next morning and say, today I talked with the King. We had breakfast. We shared together. And he kept telling me of how much he loved me. Why would you trade that just because you're afraid of saying what God already knows, that we're sinners in need of grace? Romans 3:23 says, all of us have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. All of us had our fall, just like Mephibosheth. And it leaves us crippled. It leaves us in a place where we don't love the way we ought to love. We don't love our neighbor the way we ought to love. We don't love God the way we ought to love. We don't love ourselves the way we ought to be loving ourselves. None of that is true because we've all fallen short of the glory of God. But there's a healer. There's a healer. And his name is Jesus Christ. If you receive Jesus Christ, Jesus says, I am going to take you. I won't break you. It's a wonderful verse. He says, some of you might see yourselves as bruised reeds, a reed that is bruised. It's been bent over. And what do we do with such reeds? If you have a flower and the flower stem is bent over, we just say, oh, well, we just got to take that out. It's dead. That's what people do with bruised reeds. But Jesus says, a bruised reed, I will not break. I will not break a bruised reed. If you're crippled, if you're lame, if you're broken, I will heal a bruised reed. That's what I do with bruised reeds. He said, sometimes when you look at a candle and the wick is just about to get snuffed out, he said, a smoldering wick, what do we often do with it? We just want to blow it out. He said, I will not blow it out, but I will put the fire back in the wick. That's what Jesus said. That's what Jesus does with anyone who just comes to that place and says, life has thrown me a curve and I'm crippled. and I would like to sit at the king's table. There's grace. There's grace for you. If you are somebody who has yet to put your faith in Jesus Christ, if you want to know what it means to sit at the king's table, you want to know what it is for the king of the universe to say, you don't have to be afraid. All I have is kindness for you. All I have is grace for you. All I have is love for you. Come out of the shadows. Come out of the hiding. Come into the light where you can know the dignity of being a son, a daughter of the King. I want to invite us all to just bow our heads in this moment. But I'm going to just continue to guide you right now to God in prayer. Will you identify the things that has crippled you? Maybe it was people who were supposed to love you who ended up hurting you. Maybe it was yourself. Decisions you've made that have ended up hurting others, hurting yourself, hurting God. What has crippled you? What's crippled you and causing you to hide? Just like David sought out Mephibosheth, God is seeking you out right now. He always is. But he's seeking you out here in this place. Just like the good shepherd who would always go after that one sheep, he's pursuing you. And he wants you to know that he has sent his son to redeem you, that you might be adopted as a son, adopted as a daughter of God. Will you call out to him right now and say, I'm coming out of the shadows. Here's where I'm hurting. Here's where I'm crippled. I need your grace. Oh God, I need your grace. Tired of hiding. I want to come into the light and be the person that you intended me to be. So I receive you, Jesus. I receive what you've done on the cross for me. I receive all that you are so that I might be adopted by the Father today.